You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to today's podcast, ASCO 2026 Encompass Experience, an immersive exploration of the latest in oncology care. We are pleased to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Crombie, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Senior Physician at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute Division of Lymphoma in Boston, Massachusetts. Today, we are going to explore some of the exciting new data in non-Hodgkin lymphoma that was presented at the 2026 ASCO Annual Meeting, with a focus on bispecific antibodies in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. We will specifically discuss emerging clinical evidence and practical considerations surrounding bispecific antibodies in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, including how these therapies are being integrated into treatment. In addition, we'll discuss how the emerging data may impact clinical decision-making and the care of patients with lymphoma in real-world practice. Welcome, Dr. Crombie.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to going over these new data.
Yes, we are too. So to start us off, let's take a step back and discuss how bispecific antibodies are currently being used in clinical practice today based on current guidelines.
Sure. So there are currently four available CD20, CD3 bispecific antibodies. These include mosunetuzumab, which is approved for relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, epcoritamab, which is approved for relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and glofitamab, which is approved for relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We also have odronextamab, which is available in Europe and approved by the EU for both relapsed refractory FL and DLBCL. So when I'm thinking about using bispecific antibodies in clinical practice, I think optimal patient selection really depends in part on the histology. For patients with follicular lymphoma, bispecifics are approved in the third line and beyond. And I'm really considering these agents for most patients who have been treated with at least two prior lines of therapy. We've also had some exciting clinical trials available looking at bispecifics in earlier lines of therapy in this disease. For diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, bispecifics are approved in combination with chemo in the second line and in the third line as a single agent. Most of the patients I treat with bispecifics have already been treated with CAR T-cell therapy. However, there may be some patients who have a preference to avoid CAR T for various logistical reasons, and I may consider bispecifics in these patients. I think about making sure that patients live in close proximity to the hospital, can call if they have reported side effects, and ideally have support to help them through particularly the initial part of the dose ramp-up period. But I'm really grateful to have these options available now for patients with both FL and DLBCL.
Got it. So with that, let's begin with relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, where we are already using bispecifics in clinical practice. What are the highlights of the trials that were presented at ASCO?
At ASCO, we saw some interesting data, and I can start by mentioning a few studies that focused on the second line. The first study to mention was the SUNMO study, and this is a phase 3 study that included patients with relapsed refractory large B-cell lymphoma who were not eligible for autologous stem cell transplant. And these patients were randomized 2-to-1 to either receive mosunetuzumab, the subcutaneous formulation, in combination with polatuzumab, or the chemoimmunotherapy regimen R-GemOx. And the primary endpoints were progression-free survival and overall response rate. In this study, there were 138 patients who got mosunpola and 70 who received R-GemOx, and they had a follow-up of almost 30 months. And here with longer follow-up, we saw that mosunpola continued to show an improvement in PFS over R-GemOx. The hazard ratio there was 0.41, and the overall response rate with mosunpola was 70% versus 40% with R-GemOx. In this study, the authors also focused on patients who were treated specifically in the second line, and there they saw the two-year PFS was 40% for mosunpola versus 20% with R-GemOx. So another important thing about this regimen is that it's well-tolerated. CRS rates are low with the subcutaneous mosunetuzumab and occurred in about a quarter of patients total, and less than 5% had grade 2 CRS. So I think this is an appealing option for patients who may be frailer and in practices in an attempt to avoid high rates of CRS as well. So that was one study that I wanted to mention. I think it's also worth noting a poster that looked at outcomes of a few different phase three trials in the second line. This was a study that looked at multivariable analyses for overall survival in three different phase three studies. The SUNMO study, which is the one that I just mentioned, STARGLOW, which was a study that looked at glofitamab with GemOx compared to R-GemOx, and then POLARGO, which looked at polatuzumab with GemOx as compared to R-GemOx. And so these studies all were in patients with relapsed refractory large B-cell lymphoma. They all showed improvements with the novel combination arms over R-GemOx in the second line or later. However, there may be baseline imbalances, even with randomization, that make it more challenging to compare some of these efficacy results. So in this study, the authors looked at the multivariable analyses to assess for overall survival, and they used a Cox regression model to estimate treatment effect while adjusting for some of these confounding factors. And what was interesting is that the authors found that in SUNMO, patients actually had higher risk features in the Mosin-Pola arm as compared to the R-GemOx arm. And so the multivariable adjusted hazard ratio was actually more favorable than the unadjusted hazard ratio. And the same was seen for POLARGO, but the hazard ratio for the STARGLOW study kind of largely remained unchanged. So I think this was just a study to dive a little bit deeper into the baseline characteristics to try to further interpret the outcomes of these different treatment arms. Lastly, I will mention another study that included the bispecific antibody epcoritamab, and this was a study that focused on arms 4 and arms 10 of the EPCOR NHL2 study, and both of these arms included patients who were eligible for autologous stem cell transplant. So these were patients who received chemoimmunotherapy in combination with the bispecific antibody and then had the option to go on to consolidation with a stem cell transplant. And so these two arms included two different chemoimmunotherapy backbones, either our DHAC or RICE in combination with epcoritamab. The analysis included 63 patients, and they had 18 months of follow-up of these patients. They had the majority of patients did go on and receive an autologous stem cell transplant, although 16% did just continue on maintenance without the transplant due to patient or physician preference. And in this study, they saw really high overall response rates, 84%, and a CR rate of 67%, which does seem higher than what we would expect with historical controls of chemoimmunotherapy alone. And they saw that the median duration of CR, PFS, and OS were not reached among those patients who went on to receive an autologous stem cell transplant. So I think this study, although it's single arm, a small study, does show encouraging outcomes and high response rates among these transplant eligible patients. Although the number of patients who are transplant going on to transplant in the second line is smaller now that we often use CAR T in this setting.
Very promising indeed. We are now seeing emerging data for bispecific antibodies being used in the upfront setting of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Were there any presentations at ASCO in this space that caught your eye?
Yes, I think we're seeing this across all the bispecific antibodies. You know, we started seeing them in the third line, then there were second line studies, and now we're seeing them emerge in the frontline space. And this is both for DLBCL and for follicular lymphoma. At ASCO, we saw some early results from the OlympiA 3 study, and this was an oral abstract focusing on part 1B of this trial, which ultimately will compare odronextamab CHOP to R-CHOP in patients with newly diagnosed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So in the portion that was presented at ASCO, they were focusing on exploring two different doses of odronextamab in combination with CHOP. So patients were randomized 1:1 to receive odro-CHOP with two different schedules, one every 3 weeks or one where odro was given every 2 weeks. The authors found that the safety profile for odro-CHOP was similar across the different regimens. CRS rates were also consistent with what they saw in the dose escalation portion of this study. CRS was primarily grade 1, occurring in 42.5% of patients. There was very short follow-up on this study, only just a few months, but the early overall response rate was encouraging at 95%. The CR rate, 95% with one dose schedule and 90% with the other dose schedule, and the CR rates were the same at 85%. So I think given these results, in the phase 3 portion of the study, odronextamab will be given with the less frequent dosing schedule, which I think will be more convenient for patients and align with the chemotherapy backbone scheduling. So we'll look forward to seeing the results of the next phase of that trial. There was also an abstract looking at a phase 2 trial of epcoritamab in combination with rituximab mini-CBP, and this was specific for patients who were unfit or frail or had were anthracycline ineligible, and these were also patients with newly diagnosed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In this study, epcoritamab was added in cycle 2 using step-up dosing and then used in combination with chemotherapy moving forward. And then after 6 cycles, patients who achieved a CR would complete therapy, and patients who had a partial response could continue epcoritamab maintenance for up to 12 cycles. This was an interim assessment. They plan to enroll 40 patients, and 22 patients have enrolled thus far. They saw early encouraging CR rates after 6 cycles of 86%. And they had 2 patients who achieved the PR and were continuing with the epcoritamab maintenance. They did see CRS in about half of patients, but they were all grade 1 and resolved within 1 to 2 days. So this is an attractive option, I think, for patients who are elderly or unfit. We know that dose reductions in R-CHOP can compromise outcomes compared to the full dose therapy. So it's nice to see that patients can add in a bispecific potentially with improvements in outcomes. So there have been some other studies looking at bispecifics in combination with mini R-CHOP, which were also encouraging. So this is sort of another one that shows similar findings. And then lastly, I'll mention a poster. We saw updates on the phase 2 Morning Sun study. This has been presented previously, and this looked at fixed duration subcutaneous mosunetuzumab in elderly or unfit patients with previously untreated DLBCL. So this is a single agent. These patients were older than age 80 or between 65 and 79 and ineligible for chemoimmunotherapy. This was a single-arm study where about 50 patients enrolled. The median age in this study was 83, and patients ranged from 71 to 101 years old, and about half of patients had a higher IPI of greater than 3. Follow-up here is also short, only about 12 months, but we saw the 12-month PFS and OS were 71 and 74% respectively. Overall response rate was 73%, and the CR rate was about 60%. Sub-Q mosunetuzumab also has a favorable safety profile, low rates of CRS, and in this study, 12% of patients experienced CRS, mostly grade 1, and then 2 patients with grade 2 CRS. So we've seen now a few different studies that look at single-agent bispecifics in the front line, and I think They are not as durable as some of the combination therapies that have been presented in this space. However, it's good to have some data, particularly for patients who may be very frail or older and not able to tolerate the bispecific in combination with chemo, which does come with some higher risks, including higher risks of infections. We'll need to see longer follow-up here, but this could be helpful for particular frail patients.
As you mentioned, CD20-targeted bispecifics are also approved for follicular lymphoma in the relapse refractory setting. Were there any data of interest in either of these settings presented at ASCO?
Yeah, the bispecifics are really being explored now across different subtypes of lymphoma, including follicular lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma. At ASCO, we did see an oral abstract looking at some real-world outcomes. We've seen a lot of the data in the clinical trial settings, but sometimes when we look in the real world, we see that outcomes may be slightly inferior or different when patients may be sicker or not necessarily would be candidates for a clinical trial. So in this oral abstract, patients were included from multiple U.S. centers that were included in the CUBIC Consortium, which is the Collaborative United States Bispecific Consortium. This study was a retrospective analysis that included 99 patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. Most patients received mosunetuzumab, more than 90%, and the remaining received epcoritamab. Patients were primarily older, median age was 68, and ranged from 33 to 101. Among this cohort, the overall response rate was 87% and the CR rate was 72%. Most patients responded within 3 months, and they saw that response rates were not significantly associated with the bispecific used, although, as you heard, the numbers of patients treated with epcoritamab was low. It was not also, outcomes not associated with performance status, baseline FLIPI score, LDH, or use of prior CAR-T. Follow-up was relatively short, but the 18-month PFS that was seen was around 56%, and the 18-month overall survival is 94%. CRS occurred in 34% of patients and was primarily grade 1. There were no grade 3 events, and ICANS only occurred in 3% of patients and were all grade 1. So I think here, as I mentioned, sometimes we see outcomes that are significantly inferior in the real-world setting. Here we're seeing encouraging response data in this real-world cohort of patients being treated with bispecific antibodies.
Would you tell us about the toxicity profile of bispecific antibodies and best practices for recognizing and managing treatment-related toxicities, particularly CRS and infections?
Sure. So I think the toxicity of bispecific antibodies is really important and is one of the major barriers for these drugs being used across a range of clinical practices, including in the community. One of the most important side effects to be aware of, as you mentioned, is cytokine release syndrome, or CRS. For most of the bispecifics that we have, the CRS is primarily grade 1, and there may be a few cases of grade 2, but you do have to be equipped to manage these in the event that they do occur. So I was fortunate to have the opportunity to work with an international group of physicians and other providers who were involved in some of the early clinical trials of bispecific antibodies to put together some consensus guidelines and recommendations for the management of cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicity if it does occur with these drugs. Patients can be very responsive to steroids. Many of the bispecific antibodies include steroid pretreatment or even steroids as a prophylactic measure for CRS after therapy. So dexamethasone is the preferred agent there. And then we have drugs like tocilizumab that can be used for patients who may have higher grades CRS if it does occur. Infections are also an important toxicity to be aware of. We have seen these occur. Some of the bispecific antibodies are used until patients experience progression or if they have intolerance. And so there could be an ongoing risk of infection for some of these agents. And so it's just important to be aware of those. I do use prophylactic therapy against PCP pneumonia and for BZB. I also will monitor immunoglobulin levels for patients and give IVIG for patients with recurrent infections. So those are things to be aware of. It was interesting at ASCO, we did see a poster that looked at the toxicity profile of bispecific antibodies in the real world as compared to CAR T cell therapy. And this was a retrospective cohort that looked at patients with DLBCL or FL treated with either bispecific antibodies or CAR T. And the authors used a one-to-one propensity score matching to try to match up baseline demographics, comorbidities, labs, and prior lines of therapy. And what they saw, they had a total of almost 400 patients that were included in them after matching. And they saw that compared to CAR T, bispecifics were associated with lower rates of CRS and neurologic toxicity at 30 days and 60 days, lower rates of ICU admission. However, they did see that the infection rates at 90 days and hypogammaglobulinemia at 180 days were similar between the groups. So I think that seems to kind of align with what I would expect. The toxicity, the CRS and neurotoxicity rates with bispecific antibodies are pretty low and manageable. They can occur, and though we do have to be on the lookout for infections.
What key unanswered questions or ongoing challenges still remain in the use of bispecific antibodies for NHL?
I think there are a few things. One is really where is the best place to use the bispecific antibodies. We've started using them in later lines of therapy, and now we're seeing them in earlier lines. So I think the ongoing trials that we're seeing read out now will hopefully help us answer that question as to how best to incorporate these drugs into our treatment algorithms for the various diseases. And whether it makes sense to even retreat patients if they have been exposed to bispecifics in one of their earlier lines of therapy. I think one of the major challenges that still remains is also how to get these drugs to patients across a range of clinical practice settings. CRS can be challenging to manage. It does require interdisciplinary cooperation among pharmacists and nurses and physicians, and even education to the patient and their family and caregivers, and also emergency plans and cooperation from the emergency room. And so there's just a lot to coordinate, but we know and we've seen from the various trials that these drugs are active. They do work even in heavily relapsed patients. And so I hope we can find a way to continue to expand access to these therapies and improve the comfort of using these agents across various practices, because I do think it's possible.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Crombie.
Thank you again for having me.
We've reached the end of our time for today's discussion. We hope you enjoyed this podcast episode and found the conversation to be informative. Before we conclude, we would like to thank Dr. Jennifer Crombie for sharing insights on emerging clinical data presented at the ASCO 2026 annual meeting. We also thank Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc. for providing an independent educational grant for this CME-CE activity. Finally, thank you to our audience for joining us today. We appreciate your participation and hope you found this discussion valuable. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please join us for another episode of this podcast series on ASCO 2026. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com. Thank you.